A nation remembers President Jimmy Carter as a man of faith, integrity, and good works at home and abroad.
He built houses for people that needed homes. He eliminated diseases in forgotten places. He waged peace anywhere in the world.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll reflect on President Carter's legacy on human rights. And in Southeast Asia, the Philippines is working with a former enemy to confront a common rival.
This is a key counterbalance on China's aggression.
Plus, Canadian pilots battling wildfires in L.A. and an American orchestra performing compositions from the Arab world.
Now, with everything that's going on in the Middle East, an homage to the people who lost their lives and to all of the places in the Middle East that have been destroyed.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Today in Washington, laying to rest an American president. That's the choir at the National Cathedral, part of the state funeral for James Earl Carter, Jr. There were heartfelt tributes for the 39th president from family members, including one of his grandsons, Joshua Carter.
My grandfather spent the entire time I've known him helping those in need. He built houses for people that needed homes. He eliminated diseases in forgotten places. He waged peace anywhere in the world. Wherever he saw a chance.
Jimmy Carter died at the age of 100, outliving most of those who served with him in government. But one remaining member of his inner circle spoke at the funeral this morning, his former campaign manager and White House advisor, Stuart Eisenstadt.
He uniquely combined the soft power of human rights, championing freedom for the communist East Bloc countries and tripling the emigration of Soviet Jews. He combined that with hard power, rebuilding America's military strength after its post-Watergate decline.
Five U.S. presidents attended today's funeral. President Joe Biden spoke, remembering what he considers to be one of Jimmy Carter's most important attributes.
Character. Character. Character.
Biden said Carter showed that strength of character was about more than title or power.
It's the strength to understand that everyone should be treated with dignity, respect, that everyone, and I mean everyone, deserves an even shot.
Now we're going to look at one aspect of Jimmy Carter's legacy. Back in January of 1977, when he was sworn into office, Carter signaled a change in how the U.S. would conduct its foreign policy.
Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
During his inauguration speech, Carter pledged to make human rights the foundation of the United States' approach to international affairs.
Our moral sense dictates a clear-cut preference for those societies which share with us an abiding respect for individual human rights.
Former President Carter spent a lot of time talking about human rights with Robert Strong. Those conversations were research for Strong's book, Working in the World, Jimmy Carter and the Making of American Foreign Policy. So take us back to 1977 and the global politics of the Cold War. How much of a shift was it for Carter to make human rights the centerpiece of his U.S. foreign policy?
Carter's commitment to human rights was in part a critique of the early decades of the Cold War. He supported, of course, opposition to the Soviet Union and Soviet expansion, but he felt that there were occasions when the United States erred by the association with dictators and authoritarian governments that may have been anti-communist, but were also enemies of the principles of American freedom and liberty. Carter thought we could continue to oppose the Soviet Union, but at the same time, make it clear that we supported democratization of our countries around the world. We supported respect for individual rights.
Why was this important for Jimmy Carter specifically?
I think the most important factor in Carter's commitment to human rights is what he had seen and experienced in the civil rights era in the 1960s. The success of civil rights in the South led Carter to believe that if we talk consistently about human rights, if we stand behind the things we say, over time, it could make a huge difference around the world in the same way that he saw change in the United States in the civil rights era.
Though Carter was not particularly involved with the civil rights movement, is that right?
It's complicated. In his personal life, he often stood up. When he was a member of the school board in Plains and was asked to join the White Citizens Council, he refused. When his church had a proposal to prohibit African Americans from attending services, he and his family stood up and voted against it. But in his political career, he did not advocate desegregation of schools in conjunction with the Supreme Court decision unless and until the federal courts ordered Georgia to do so. He was a moderate on racial questions because he wanted to win office when he was elected governor in 1970. Once he did win office, he famously said, "The era of segregation is over." That surprised a lot of people in the audience. It surprised a lot of people who had voted for Jimmy Carter.
So how did Carter's emphasis on human rights actually change the way that the business of American foreign policy was carried out?
Well, first of all, an office for human rights and humanitarian affairs was established in the State Department. Carter appointed Pat Darian, who was active in the civil rights movement, to head that office and insisted that major policy decisions had to be considered in connection with the impact they might have on human rights. He once told me that in almost every meeting he had with a head of state, he had individual cases that he would bring up. A dissident who was being held in prison, a critic who was being cut off from access to their political speech. Now, he didn't always succeed in getting his interlocutor to take positive action, but he often did. And Jimmy Carter remembered the names of the people whose lives were changed by those high-level interventions.
I want to get to South Africa. This was the late 1970s. Apartheid was the law of the land. How did Carter deal with the government there?
Carter was an advocate of sanctions against South Africa for its apartheid policy. But I think it's interesting that he didn't go as far as some of the liberals in Congress wanted him to. He wanted those sanctions to draw attention to the international criticism of South Africa's race relations. But he didn't want them to be so harsh that the white minority would dig in harder and resist those pressures. So he wanted to see change in South Africa the way he had seen it in the American South. And he thought shining a light on it was important, but the most rigorous sanctions might actually backfire.
In the case of Argentina, I understand that he was more direct. This was during the Dirty War when some opponents of the Argentine regime were being disappeared. And he sent U.S. diplomats to Argentina who denounced the use of torture there.
Including his wife.
Yeah. How much of an impact did that end up having?
Well, I'm sure it had some impact. I think it was most controversial, the human rights agenda, in Latin America, because those were countries with long associations with the United States who were not on the front line of the Cold War, except perhaps Cuba. And in those countries, I think Carter and the Carter administration felt that they could exercise more pressure. And in a number of countries, including Brazil and Argentina, were fairly aggressive in pushing for human rights reform. Carter's critics said he was harder on our friends in Latin America than he was on the Soviet Union.
When you interviewed President Carter in the 80s, how did he talk about his experience trying to implement a human rights-based foreign policy?
He talked about it in a remarkably matter-of-fact way. He said it was often controversial, but he said it didn't matter. He thought the president should do what is right, even if it isn't popular.
Robert Strong is senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. The last time Japan sent significant numbers of troops to the Philippines was during World War II, an invasion that destroyed much of the country and killed 1 million Filipinos, by some estimates. But that was 80 years ago. Now the government in Manila wants to see Japanese troops in the Philippines and in the seas nearby. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, the two countries are teaming up to face a common rival.
a Chinese Navy helicopter hovering over small Filipino fishing boats in December, just hundreds of miles from the Philippines' coast, as if to say, these are Chinese waters. Get lost. Sometimes Chinese forces are more hands-on. Chinese Coast Guard ships and troops, months ago, swarming a Philippine military vessel, again in Philippine waters, as defined by the United Nations Law of the Sea. This is Asia's biggest naval standoff. China claims seas within a couple hundred miles off Philippine shores. It is an easy country to pick on because its navy is far weaker. But maybe Beijing will think twice if Japan's navy, the second biggest in East Asia, has the Filipinos' back.
This is a counterbalance, a big counterbalance on China's aggression.
Chester Cabalza is a Manila-based security expert heading a think tank called International Development and Security Cooperation. He's also advised the Philippines National Security Council. He calls this new alliance with Japan a quantum leap. It still needs Japanese lawmakers' final approval, but that's expected to come soon.
This is the best option coming from an Asian neighbor. Used to be an oppressor during the colonial period, but things can change.
Filipinos over the age of 90 might remember Japan's Imperial Army massacring people. That invasion started hours after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, because the Philippines was, and still is, a U.S. ally. But Chester Cabalza says, no hard feelings. As Catholics, he says, Filipinos are taught to embrace former enemies.
I think it boils down to a religious perspective. Filipino culture is a forgiving culture.
The deal would see Japanese battalions stationed on Philippine bases, rotating in and out, and Japan's high-tech navy patrolling alongside Philippine ships. This is a huge step for Japan, too, a country that, for decades, has played down its power, trying to not remind Asia of its warmongering past.
So clearly, Japan has changed.
Satoru Nago is a military analyst in Tokyo with the Hudson Institute. He was once a first lieutenant in Japan's military. He says this alliance with the Philippines is historical. But is it also dangerous? Risking a showdown that could drag in the United States. With both the Philippines and Japan, the U.S. is sworn to defend them if China were to attack, even at sea.
That could happen, but still, war is a possibility not promised.
The thinking inside Japan's military, Nagao says, is China's navy will take over neighbors' islands and seas if it senses any weakness.
When they find a power vacuum, China tried to steal it. That is China's strategy.
Chinese forces have already seized islands in Philippine waters, turning them into fortresses. It often sends warships near disputed islands claimed by Japan, too. Beijing has a similar feud with Vietnam, and of course it claims the entire island of Taiwan, an autonomous democracy with its own government. Professor Nago says Asian countries have to team up or get rolled over.
It is unavoidable. China will come.
Beijing depicts the situation very differently, saying even though certain waters may be closer to other countries' coasts, they've been Chinese for centuries. That's a Chinese colonel, Zhang Xiaogang, recently saying the Philippines resisting China's claims is a pathetic game to get sympathy. Beijing also calls the two countries pawns of the U.S. Japan swooping in to support the Philippines is reviving talk of an Asian NATO, an idea Japan's own prime minister once advocated. But security analyst Chester Cabalza says it's probably not happening.
Right now, I think it's not yet probable to have that kind of setup in the region.
Two nations teaming up is one thing, Cabalza says, but joining a huge U.S.-backed alliance in Asia would really infuriate Beijing. And that's not a risk countries are ready to take, even if China is nibbling at their territory. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
More global news is just ahead for you. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Wildfires continue to rage across parts of Los Angeles. More than 800 firefighters are battling the blazes on the ground and from the air. That includes personnel and aircraft from Canada. Two water bombers belonging to the Quebec government are on the front lines. So are water bombing helicopters from Coulson Aviation, based in British Columbia. Wayne Coulson is the company's CEO. I asked him what his pilots were able to accomplish last night.
We flew on the Sunset Fire about 55,000 gallons last night. And on the Palisades Fire, we flew about 60,000 gallons. And that's typically what we do at night with these big firebombing helicopters, is structure protection and try and slow the head down for the firefighters and support the ground firefighters.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when you're fighting a fire from above, but there are houses that I imagine you can't just drop tons of water on, what is the strategy? Where are you looking to aim that water being launched from those helicopters?
We have an intel helicopter above us that's providing us intelligence. And what they have is they have a camera, a thermal imaging camera on board. And at night, we'll use a laser illuminator. A laser's fired from the intel helicopter. It's the size of a car. And you can see it through the night vision goggles and the firebombing helicopters. And we work our way around so the thermal imaging camera can see the firefighters, so we can see where they are. We have ground communication so we can talk to them. So the intel is communicating minute by minute with the ground. We're talking to them. We're telling them what we're seeing. We're actually capturing data and blowing it down to them in real time onto their iPhones or to the incident command team. It's very much a dance during the evenings.
So that sounds like that surveillance gives you kind of the eyes in the air on this fire. How does that then impact where you're dropping water?
In talking to the ground, you know, they'll provide advice of what they need. We have the agency representative in the intel helicopter, and they're providing us as the fire manager. So they're also providing, he or she is providing us information of what they want on the ground as well. So we really don't go and make, you know, other than, hey, if they want to knock that the flames down around a home, we'll just go and do it. But we're being told what to do, and we're providing intelligence to the customer to get them the best information they can to provide us the direction that we need.
By agency, I assume you mean the local firefighting authority?
It would be, in the case, it could be LA County, Orange County, or Ventura County representatives in the aircraft with us.
So do your pilots have to be careful not to drop all this water directly onto homes?
No, we control the volume that's flowing from the tank on every drop.
What have you been hearing from your pilots today?
We continue to be in red flag warnings down here in Southern California. Some tough days ahead still yet. We had 3 new starts yesterday that we caught. So that didn't become big incidences. You know, it's very much a coordinated effort down here, the state of California, the other agencies between Orange, Ventura, and LA and LA City, that we're all working as one big happy family down here and working with the ground to support them wherever we can.
Canada is a country with, you know, a vast wilderness, and of course, we've seen enormous wildfires there. I'm wondering if fighting wildfires from the air is something of a specialty in Canada.
I mean, we do. We have lots of aerial firefighting companies. It's just different tactics. We fly intel helicopters as well as firebombing airplanes and firebombing helicopters in multiple countries. So we're in Australia right now. We have the largest fleet in country in Australia. We're the largest fleet in South America, down in Chile. And then, of course, up here in North America, where this fleet runs.
You, as you said, have operations all around the world. You're working 24-7. You're working, 365 days a year in L.A., or you're available. I mean, does anything strike you about this particular fire, or the fact that you have such global, intense firefighting operations? Just, I don't know, sign of the times these days?
You know, the fires are definitely getting more intense. They say with the global warming that, you know, the impact of fire is going to double over the next 10 years. So I think what people are finding out, whether, you know, it doesn't matter what country you're in, that the level of preparedness required to fight the fight today is significantly different than it was 1 or 2 decades ago.
Wayne Coulson of Coulson Aviation speaking from Los Angeles this afternoon. The Canadian company's helicopters are on the front lines of the massive wildfires there. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek has been tracing the journey of early human migration, walking about 15 miles a day for the past 11 years. That is a lot of nights looking for a place to sleep. And in South Korea, he found an option he hadn't come across before, the Love Motel, rented by the hour. It is exactly what you think, but also just the thing for a weary traveler. Paul Salopek sent us this audio postcard.
My walking partner, Lee Jun-suk, and I are hiking across South Korea. We're staying in love motels. What is a Korean love motel? From the outside, many such establishments look ordinary. Aging faux brick facades, sliding glass doors activated by touch, an electronic sign dusted by air pollution. Inside, the clerk is hidden in a frosted glass booth. You transact business through a small opening of the type that guards push meals through in prison doors. The clerk cannot see you. You cannot see him. Inside the rooms, more clues appear. Heart-shaped beds, sachets of perfume, cologne, and mouthwash, as well as sanitizing alcohol and condoms. In one such room, I discover a laminated menu, not for ordering food, but instead listing women performers available for hire. Each photographed attired in the exhausted tropes of male fantasy, a nun, a dominatrix, an air steward. One rents these rooms by the hour. Love motels may have been invented back in the day as a front for prostitution, but their role has evolved. Today, most love motels provide a moderately acceptable hutch where ordinary young Korean couples can enjoy fleeting privacy, that is, away from the family gaze. A government study conducted in 2021 reveals that 62% of the unmarried population of South Korea between the ages of 20 and 44 still live at home with their parents, hence the vast demand for an intimate escape valve. Korea's brand of capitalism on steroids has met this challenge by building love motels across the nation. How many? It's impossible to say. There are reputed to be hundreds of love motels operating in the capital, Seoul, alone. "Tell him we need two rooms for the whole night," I instruct my walking partner Lee at one such establishment. Lee bends to convey this information in Korean through the clerk's tiny window. There is an exclamation of surprise from behind the opaque glass. "Ask him if I may borrow a desk and chair," I also remind Lee, "because I'm a writer." And from behind the glass comes an even louder grunt of astonishment. After one such request, the love motel clerk opened his booth door and handed over the stool he was sitting on. Such customer service is rare anywhere these days. South Korea's love motels are inexpensive, perhaps $8 an hour or $45 a night. It is not easy to book ahead. One sometimes must simply show up. Perfect for miserly walkers.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek in South Korea. You're listening to The World. Lebanon has been without a government for 2 years, but now it has a new president who's calling for militia groups to be disarmed.
This kind of speeches can get you killed. And this would not be an overstatement in Lebanon.
More about the former army chief turned president, Joseph Aoun. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Syria, they are all under severe economic sanctions. It is Russia, though, that's by far the most sanctioned country on Earth since it launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine nearly 3 years ago. But these sanctions have not prevented European nations from importing a record high amount of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, from Russia. Jan-Erik Feinrich is an analyst at Rystad, an independent research company in Oslo, Norway. He started by telling me how much LNG Europe imported from Russia last year.
So in 2024, for the full year, we saw an import level of 17.8 million tons that came via ship from Russia to Europe.
And how does that compare to previous years?
So it's not only up 18% year on year, it's actually a record level. So it's the highest LNG imports from Russia that we have on record.
And how surprising is that, given that Europe has been trying to stop buying Russian energy?
That really depends on which angle we take. If we take a political angle, it's very surprising. As you said in your intro, Europe has taken political steps to get rid of Russian hydrocarbons and Russian energy. However, it's actually stopped short of imposing sanctions that prevent imports. So politically, it seems surprising, but economically, it's not surprising at all. The reason is that in terms of pricing, Russian LNG is actually favorable compared to other producers. The reason being that especially Yamal LNG, the biggest Russian plant, is very close to Europe. And so it's cheaper in terms of production to get the LNG to Europe.
So Europe has sanctioned, what, coal and oil from Russia, but not natural gas? Is that right?
That's exactly right. And the simple reason is that there were fears for security of supply among European member states. So direct sanctions on Russian gas imports just wouldn't have had the majority they would have needed to pass.
Okay. So lots of gas has stopped flowing through pipelines from Russia to Europe. So overall, how much gas is Russia sending into Europe compared to pre-war levels?
So this is where we really see the efforts of the European Union pay off. Because if we even look at only pipeline imports, they used to peak at more than 200 billion cubic meters, which is now reduced to only 32 in 2024. So almost a sevenfold reduction. And the slight increase in LNG volumes does by no means make up for that. So in total, we are talking about roughly 56 billion cubic meters that have made their way from Russia to Europe, either via pipe or via ship.
And that's compared to what levels again before the full-scale invasion?
Yeah, that's compared to in 2021 and 2022, which were the record years, roughly 230 BCM.
Okay. Europe has stepped up imports of LNG from other places, too, to kind of make up the difference of Russian energy that they're not buying, correct?
Historically speaking, yes, especially in the direct aftermath of the war, so especially in 2022 and 2023. This year, we've actually seen a reversal, though. So if we compare year on year, LNG imports have actually gone down in 2024, and substantially so, by almost 20%.
Wow, okay. So what's making up the difference?
The difference is essentially strong pipeline flows from Norway, but funny enough, also from Russia, despite all the efforts. And then secondly, the fact that demand is stagnant to slightly shrinking. And the third factor are storage withdrawals. So for everyone who's followed the news recently, there's been concern on very strong, very fast storage drawdowns in Europe. So this has been another source of gas.
It sounds like there is this publicly voiced interest by the EU to stop using Russian fossil fuels by 2027. Given this data of increased LNG imports, is Europe on track to reach that goal?
That's a very difficult question. So economically, as I tried to lay out, there's very little reason to do it. So if the 2027 sort of phase out of Russian fossil fuels is going to happen, it has to be driven politically. And that means that if the European Commission can reach consensus and can mobilize its member states to agree to it, it will happen, irrespective of commercial interests. However, until then, it's quite possible that the market anticipates such a measure and actually increases Russian imports in anticipation, because they will know that this cheap source of supply will be going away once such legislation is passed.
Jan Erik Feinrich is a gas analyst at Rystad Energy. He joined us to discuss the company's data on Russian gas imports to Europe last year. When Russia's full-scale invasion began in Ukraine nearly 3 years ago, people quickly took steps to save precious works of art and museum pieces. But what's to be done about the objects and the buildings that cannot be moved out of harm's way? In Ukraine's western city of Lviv, Lydia Tomku reports on how Ukraine's wooden churches are being protected.
That's the sound of a high-tech Leica laser scanner at the Lviv Polytechnic National University in western Ukraine. It's white and boxy and spins on a tripod as it maps its surroundings.
We use it in our trips, scanning 3D scanning of Ukrainian wooden churches, 17th, 18th centuries.
Ilya Litvinchuk is an assistant in the Department of Architecture and Conservation and has been part of the team going into the field to ensure there is an architectural record of Ukraine's wooden religious heritage. Sometimes that work takes them very close to the front lines. One church Ilya is hoping to scan in the Kherson region.
5 kilometers between Berislav and front line.
Litvinchuk shows a completed scan of a Ukrainian wooden church, a tsarkva, on a large computer screen. Scanning a church in its entirety can take a full day. The team has to set up the Leica dozens of times, once as many as 70 times. They usually do it in black and white to save time so they aren't in dangerous areas for too long. Once they're back in the lab, it all must be processed.
My work is to register this raw data from stations, scan stations.
But that's not where the job ends. Ultimately, the goal is to create detailed architectural plans for every church that's scanned, says project leader Mykola Bevs, who is head of the Architecture and Conservation Department. Bevs was part of the team that in 2013 helped get UNESCO World Heritage recognition for 16 wooden churches in the Carpathian region of Ukraine and Poland. That's just a tiny fraction of Ukraine's well over 2,000 wooden tsarkvas. From his office inside the impressive neo-Renaissance and neo-Baroque Polytechnic building, Bevs pulls up detailed drawings and church scans on his computer. So far, we only have models and not all the architectural drawings. But this is very important, he says, because if there was a fire in this church now, or a shell hit it, for example, and the Russians destroyed a part of the church, we already know exactly what was destroyed, what it looked like before, and we can use it to rebuild. Last year, the team scanned 11 churches, including the 9-domed Tsarkva of the Holy Trinity in the eastern Dnipropetrovsk region that dates to 1775. The high-resolution scanning means there's detailed documentation of the building's structure, which could potentially be used in legal proceedings, as well as the religious artifacts and artwork inside, in case any are looted. We can scan all sorts of monuments, even if they're not on the front lines, he says. Today, the war is going on all over Ukraine, so it would be good to scan all the most prominent churches. More than 140 religious sites have already been damaged in the war. But Bev says that so far, all the churches they've scanned remain standing. Bev's colleague, Professor Yaroslav Taras, is an architect and ethnologist who has written several books on Ukraine's sacred wooden architecture, which he says is full of different styles and elements across regions. Ukrainian sacred architecture is different from all the others because it is one of the markers of Ukrainian identity, he says. The churches are breathtaking in their craftsmanship. The wooden structures are almost reminiscent of Japanese pagodas, but with huge domes and cupolas. No two are alike. Many contain colorful religious iconography and carved wooden details. Father Sebastian Dmitvor stands in the midst of a trove of such treasures, piled high to the ceiling of a storage room at the Metropolitan Andriy Sheptytsky Museum in Lviv, where he works on the preservation of architectural monuments.
He says he has more than 6,000 items.
His specialty is sacred art. He says there is a dark history of the Soviets destroying Ukrainian wooden churches and priests being arrested. Ukrainian sacred architecture and art show the spirituality, history, and culture of the country, he says. That's why in our time we need to protect sacred artworks very carefully, he says. Our libraries, our icons, our churches, because they are unique masterpieces of architecture and art. Yuri Yanchishin, a conservator of wooden artifacts and researcher and scholar, has been volunteering with the project. He recalls being dumbfounded the first time he entered a wooden tsarkva. He says they're an example of vernacular or folk architecture, architecture built by local parishioners and craftsmen. Many have no nails and are held together with either pegs or mortise and tenon joinery.
And these churches are distinguished by their tripartite, which means three sections, design. And they have very, in some cases, very bold architectural features, especially when the bell towers are incorporated into the structure of the church itself.
Carolyn Guile is an art historian who studies wooden vernacular architecture in the region. She's also the president of the nonprofit that donated the scanner to Lviv Polytechnic,
She says it's a shame these spectacular churches aren't better known around the world, but that there's a reason for it.
Where does this region fit into specializations in academia? It hasn't even risen to the surface until fairly recently of many of these departments and programs that purport to work on or showcase this area of the world. It's often been done through the lens of, you know, how these relate to Russian history or what have you.
She adds that it's crucial to remember that these churches are more than just physical marvels. They're places of community, fixtures in the fabric of Ukrainians' daily lives.
It's important to understand cultural heritage in general as more than just kind of static repository of human activity. These are living things.
For The World, I'm Lydia Tomku, Lviv, Ukraine.
Staying with Ukraine a moment longer, President Volodymyr Zelensky and U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin held their final meeting today at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The two used the occasion to argue for military support to Ukraine to continue after Donald Trump is inaugurated this month.
We've come such a long way that it would honestly be crazy to drop the ball now and not keep building on the defense coalitions we've created.
That was Zelensky addressing the Ukraine Defense Contact Group, made up of 50 countries that support Ukraine. For his part, Austin announced a U.S. aid package of $500 million.
It includes additional missiles for Ukrainian air defense, more ammunition, more air-to-ground munitions, and other equipment to support Ukraine's F-16s.
The current administration has worked to provide Ukraine with as much military support as it can before Biden leaves office this month. A new ensemble of young, classically trained musicians are turning their focus to contemporary Middle Eastern music. The group performed last fall in New York City and New Haven, Connecticut, and subsequently recorded an album of works by Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian composers. Jeff London sent us this report from New York.
Lebanese composer Sami Saif says the group carefully chose its name.
The name of the ensemble, Riwaya, that means story or sometimes narrative. And that was important to us, of course, as an ensemble that seeks to tell the story, maybe perhaps to change the story.
The founders of Riwaya Ensemble, all young U.S. music school grads, met online, looking to collaborate on pieces by Middle Eastern composers, says Noemi Shimali, a French-Lebanese-American violist.
We all sort of had this meeting all together to say, okay, we're each interested in this work, we're each doing our own projects, why don't we combine forces to make an ensemble?
I was just so happy to meet other artists who shared that vision.
Palestinian-American clarinetist Amer Hassan is a co-founder of Riwaya Ensemble.
And I was so glad to finally have the ensemble up and running after just a few months of meeting them.
One of the pieces the group played in November is Karim Rustom's Palestinian Songs and Dances for Clarinet, String Quartet, and Audio Playback. One of the movements is called Dance of the Mizwiz, and it requires Amer Hassan to mimic that instrument on his clarinet.
The Mizwiz itself, it's, I guess, similar to like a bagpipe. It's a double-reeded instrument without the bag. And so just trying to create this kind of sound that had the same kind of nasally type of tone, very projecting, at the same time very resonant. And I was very, very happy to be able to pull into my toolbox of contemporary techniques.
Elements of Middle Eastern folk music are part of Sami Saif's piece Syriac Fugato 2, a duet for violin and viola. In this case, Arabic maqam music, which uses particular modes and rhythms. Saif says trying to notate this traditional improvised idiom for Western instruments wasn't easy, but he was happy with how it turned out.
I liked the results because it was a challenge of how to create the kind of freedom I look for in music, the kind of freedom that exists in Arabic music, and put it into Western ensemble music.
Another piece that Rawaya Ensemble has performed and recorded is by British-Lebanese composer Bushra El Turk, called Saffron Dusk. Violist Noemi Shamali says this string quartet tells a very specific story.
It was written as a sort of remembrance for the August 2020 Beirut seaport explosion, which, if you remember, was a very devastating explosion, the largest non-nuclear explosion to date. And it was a very traumatic time for a lot of Lebanese people. And of course, this has resonances now with everything that's going on in the Middle East, an homage to the people who lost their lives and to all of the places in the Middle East that have been destroyed from such devastating explosions over time.
Explosions and lives lost, not just in Lebanon, but Gaza and Syria. Noemi Shamali says playing music by composers either from those places or with links to them has been a salve.
It's easy to feel helpless in the face of global challenges, such as what's going on in the Middle East, but I think having a practical avenue along with these guys has really been a highlight. I guess a silver lining would be the best way to explain it.
And clarinetist Amer Hassan says he hopes Rawaya Ensemble really can change the narrative.
Ultimately, our mission is to make sure that, you know, this music is performed and it's celebrated, and of course it's heard.
For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Lebanon is just starting to emerge from war between Hezbollah and Israel. It's in its sixth year of an economic crisis, and it hasn't had a president since 2022. Lebanon's parliament has tried and failed to elect one many times over the past few years. But today, lawmakers got it done. They picked the Lebanese army general Joseph Aoun to be the next president. Journalist Alia Ibrahim, a co-founder of the online Lebanese news site Daraj, told us about the general today.
General Aoun for a very long time has been keeping a very low profile. You could say he's a trusted and unproblematic persona for the Lebanese. The last few months, especially during the period of the war, he's been playing an important role at the head of the military institution. There was a veto on him by the Shiite political parties, by Hezbollah and Amal. In that sense, it has been marketed that he is not a favorite candidate for the presidency. And we saw a little bit of that during the election today. It has become very clear over the last few weeks that General Aoun is a favorite candidate, but also he's not a politician. He comes from the army.
Is there anything that stands out about his record as a general?
I think in the Lebanese context, what's important is that he's not known to be corrupt. And this was very much reflected in the speech he gave today. He repeated different times the term accountability, the term reform, which is really of major importance in the Lebanese political context. Because over the last few years, especially after the collapse of the economy in Lebanon, we've been dealing with the huge fall down of the state, largely linked to the corruption of the political establishment. He started his speech speaking about the judiciary reform and the independence of the judiciary, and then he repeated it different times throughout his speech. We're talking about a major promise. I mean, if he succeeds in doing that, this will be a major breakthrough. Because, you know, over the last few years, we've had investigations that had touched the life of every single Lebanese person, whether at the level of the economy or, more importantly, at the level of the Beirut port explosion. The main judge who has been working on this file has been sidelined and not allowed to continue his job, mostly because of the accusations he made to politicians. Today, he made it very clear. He said there will be no immunities to any criminals. There will be no money laundering. There will be no drug trafficking. He repeated them. And we all know The political establishment, mostly led by Hezbollah, has been covering all these violations. The interference in the judiciary has been one of the biggest problems in this country. And he spoke about the exclusivity of weapons in the arms of the state.
Tell me more about what that means. That's kind of his position regarding Hezbollah, is that right?
We are talking about disarming all political parties and militias. It is in the constitution, but since then it has been translated that Lebanon's right for resistance translated to allow Hezbollah to keep its weapons. Today, the president has been very clear in saying that the only side that will be holding weapons is the army.
So he very clearly said he intends to de-arm Hezbollah.
He did not mention Hezbollah, but he repeatedly, at least twice, said that there will be no arms with anybody but the state. But it was very clear that this is what he meant. I know it's just a speech, but in the Lebanese context, again, we've had repeatedly governments would keep weeks delaying the formation or the announcement of a government because of this agreement over semantics and over what a speech or a statement of the government looked like. And these terms were always controversial. Today, it was not at all nuanced. It was really extremely clear. This kind of speeches can get you killed. And this would not be an overstatement in Lebanon. Mm.
I want to talk about outside of Lebanon for just a second. There have been huge political shifts in the region with the fall of Assad, the war between Israel and Iran's proxy Hezbollah. Who are the new president Joseph Aoun's allies outside of Lebanon?
Well, we know for a fact the context within which the session today was held came because of the huge support and borderline pressure by the U.S., by the Gulf countries, European countries. And it was also obvious because of the ambassadors attending the session.
It sounds like maybe Iran is the biggest loser here in terms of influence.
In terms of influence in Lebanon, absolutely, yes, for now. But what we know for sure is that the supply chain between Iran and Lebanon is now cut.
The supply chain for weapons for Hezbollah is what you're talking about.
Absolutely, yes.
So Lebanon has a unique power-sharing government that was created at the end of a long civil war there. Can you explain quickly how that influences who might become president?
After the civil war, the Taif Accord, the presidency lost some of the power. The executive power is now in the hand of the president, who is a Christian Maronite, but also in partnership with the prime minister, who is a Sunni. If we don't have a president, we didn't have a prime minister for 2.5 years because the cabinet has to be appointed by the president. The level of expectations today that the president set is really very high, and that could be very quickly compromised by who his prime minister is going to be.
Aliyah Ibrahim with us from the news site Daraj. A quick return now to the top story out of Washington today. The state funeral for President Jimmy Carter was held at the National Cathedral this morning. President Biden paid his respects, describing Carter as a man of faith and integrity, as did Andrew Young, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He was appointed to that post by Jimmy Carter in 1977.
I've known President Carter for more than half of my life. And I never cease to be surprised. I never cease to be enlightened. I never cease to be inspired by the little deeds of love and mercy that he shared with us every day of his life.
For the closing of today's funeral, Trisha Yearwood and Garth Brooks performed John Lennon's Imagine, one of Carter's favorite songs.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here again tomorrow.
If you care. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of men.
imagine all
the people. The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.